Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Leslie Colgan as my special expert guest. Leslie Colgan, Master of Science, is president of the Colgan Institute, a consulting, educational, and research facility formed in 1974. The Colgan Institute is primarily concerned with the effects of nutrition and exercise on athletic performance, aging, and the prevention of degenerative disease. Leslie designs the unique vitamin and mineral supplements and packs distributed by the Institute worldwide, including the equine and canine formulas. She also oversees the individual client nutritional programs. Leslie is the co-author of The Flavonoid Revolution and You Can Prevent Cancer, and also writes and oversees the email distribution of the highly regarded and very informative Colgan Institute newsletter. Good morning, Leslie, and thank you very much for participating as my guest on this edition of SNU.
Thank you very much, Corey, and good morning to you.
So can you tell us about your education background? And I think that Tracy and I and a lot of people would love to know how you and Michael first met.
Well, it wasn't all that exciting, but my background, as you said, I have an MS in nutrition, and I did my bachelor's first in psychology, so it's kind of an interesting degree. And I got that at Auckland University, and that's where I met Michael. He was actually a lecturer at Auckland University at the time, and we met not long after I'd finished my degree. And that's it. That was almost 30 years ago now. So,
are you born and raised in New Zealand?
I was, yes. Michael came to New Zealand when he was 15 with his parents, but I was born and raised in New Zealand.
And he came from England originally?
Yes, yes, he was from England.
So he's a Limey.
He is.
And a Kiwi.
And I'm a Kiwi, yes. That's
so
right.
do you squeeze the lime over the Kiwi, or the opposite to that?
I'm not quite sure, actually. I think it varies from day to day.
Both are excellent nutrition, aren't they?
They are.
Now, I know, like, I've been to New Zealand, and what a fantastic country. What a beautiful place. What are your thoughts on New Zealand and the nutrition standards there compared to, say, North America, in your experience?
It's interesting, actually. New Zealand is in a unique position that it could become a very well-known organic producer because it has beautiful countryside. Agriculture has always been big in New Zealand, as we know. But in comparison to some areas of the US, it's very behind. There are small pockets of organic produce now happening in organic agriculture. But the country it's actually very isolated, which is why we're no longer there, because it's definitely beautiful. And the isolation gives you some advantages in that it's quite pollution-free in many ways, but in others it puts you a little behind the mainstream. And I think they need to do some catching up, because it certainly could be a leader in the organic industry.
I found it to be a lot like Canada in some ways, like the landscape. It varies rapidly, like in a very short period of time. You're rolling through the hills, and then you've got a tundra. But what you've got there that I envy is the tropical part, like up in Auckland and the north part of New Zealand.
Absolutely, the country is so diverse because you've got from the very top, as you say, subtropical, right down to the bottom end of the country, which of course is very cold. So you have a huge range in terms of growing produce as well that they really are not taking advantage of, but it certainly is very lovely. I mean, when you think it's the same size as California state and there's only 3 million people there, you get to understand just how unpopulated it is.
What are some of the most popular foods there that are more traditional to Kiwis that live there that maybe wouldn't be as common here in Canada?
Lamb is a big part of the diet there just because that is our prime, probably, meat source. But something that a lot of people probably don't realize is New Zealand has a very thriving venison industry now. We had a huge problem there, as many countries do, with deer being introduced. And they have now been farmed regularly for 10 years to the extent that you now see deer grazing in fields like you would cows everywhere else, with fields and fences that are no longer the very tall fences that they had to, because they now have become essentially domesticated. So it's a huge export market now, is venison, and it's really nice.
And who doesn't like venison? Anyone that's in the know understands that the fat profile is superb. The fatty acid construct is ideal, and it just, it's a nicer tasting, more beneficial type of meat, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And for the New Zealand farmer, it's actually extremely easy to produce. What they do is they leave them out in the range area, and they bring them down into the lower pasture areas, because New Zealand is still into pasture and not feedlots, thank goodness. And they bring them down into the lower, greener pastures just before they're sent to market. And again, they do that mostly with the younger animals. So you no longer have the problem with very gamey meat. It tastes not that much different now than top quality beef, but it is very lean because, of course, deer don't put on that same weight. And they're not feedlot either. It's all natural pasture. You know, they're just out on natural pasture. Huge difference.
Now, let's get into that difference, because just today I was talking to Ruby. She asked me, Dad, why shouldn't we drink cow's milk sold in the stores? And so I had to get into, you know, the food that's fed to the cattle and the pesticides. And so when you say feedlot versus pasture, maybe you can expand on that and tell us the difference between an animal that's raised one versus the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of our meat animals are grazing animals. They were foragers. They roamed around pasture grasslands, eating whatever they could find, including leaves of trees, which a lot of people wouldn't imagine that cows would eat, or deer. And what we have done is we have taken them and we started feeding them grains that they never got, or got very rarely, in their natural environment. And a very good example of this one is corn. Corn has never been eaten by animals, and yet, because of the excess of corn that is produced in the States, a lot of animals now are fed that in feedlots, and the only thing that does to them is put on a lot of fat, and it makes them get bigger quicker. But it is not healthy meat for them, and it's not healthy for them to be fed it, and it's certainly not healthy for us to eat it. Back to more traditional farming methods, where we allow our animals to forage in the summer on pastures, and then in the winter we should feed them a lot of hay, you know, just obviously dried pasture land, which is essentially what they used to forage for themselves.
Plus the animals are moving around a lot more, I guess, in the pasture-fed model versus
Well, absolutely. They have to actually get some exercise as well, which changes the fat-to-meat ratio too. And it's the type of fat as well, Corey. As you're well aware, there's different types of fat in the human body. Well, the same applies to the animals as well. You know, that wondrous, big, thick piece of fat that used to be on traditional steaks I knew when I was growing up, that's not natural to the animal at all. That is, you know, we have put that on them because of the way that we have confined them and the way that we feed them.
So if the animals are wearing the excess, then we end up wearing it as well, don't we?
We do. We absolutely do.
It's
and
so
the quality
simple.
Of the protein that, I mean, a lot of people, and again, Michael has been discussing this just recently. He's been doing some research on this with the whole organic movement, is that corn, for instance, is not a protein that our body uses very well, because it wasn't a protein that we evolved with. And the structure of that corn remains a protein of a corn structure even after we've taken it in. So you can actually measure people's DNA and you can see the prime source of the food that they've been eating from the structure of the protein. It's quite interesting, actually.
That is amazing. And you know, I just want to congratulate both you and Michael, because you bring this science out to us in a startling, refreshing, absorbable, understanding way. And we need this information. And you guys have been so consistent ever since you started the Colgan Institute, and still are going so strong. You're just quite an amazing couple.
Thank you, Corey. We try.
Well, as president of the Institute, you know, you're so busy with so many things, and maybe you can just tell our listeners, because SNU has really grown. We've got an international population, and maybe just give them in a nutshell what the Colgan Institute is all about, how it's evolved and changed, and why it's a leading-edge consulting and research facility.
Oh, goodness, that's an awful lot of information. We came out to San Diego in 1982 after Michael had been working with Jonas Salk and Linus Pauling. And with grants through them and from other organizations, that's when we first founded the Institute out there. From then, we were working with other university groups, and we've continued to do so, to do research, because as you know, it's extremely expensive research facilities and the equipment that you need for it. So we continue to work with other groups to do the actual research, because it's obviously not cost effective to duplicate those types of laboratories. But with our own clients, we work, as you know, with individuals, with athletes, executives, all kinds of people. And over a long period of time, we've developed a computer program that, with a huge amount of variables in it, from all the questions we ask people, from all the tests that we do. And from this, we developed a supplement program that we could individualize for clients. And that's what's kind of unique about what we do. So for an athlete in a specific sport, we can look at their weaknesses and their strengths, and we can design a supplement program around that. It's quite difficult, and it's been a long time, forever changing computer database that we have that we work with. And it's from this that we developed our supplement packs that, as you know, we sell online as well, because we decided after about 10 years that we had so much information that, and we had a lot of people asking us, well, you make this available, but I can't afford to come and see you personally. Can I also get some sort of supplement program like this? So that's why we started to develop our supplement packs. So we took like a mythical person, perhaps your 40-year-old housewife, and we put in the variables that would most closely match that type of person. And the pack that it came out with was our very first women's pack. And then we did something very similar for a men's pack. And we then progressively went through altering the variables, and that's where we came through with all our basic packs that I know you're familiar with. And since then, we've started developing our add-on packs, the latest, of course, being the brain protection pack that we've developed from Michael's book, new book, Save Your Brain. So that's a big part of what we do, too. We work with individuals, and we've had a lot of clients, some of them with us now for over 20 years, who come and see us once a year, and who have been taking their supplements faithfully since then. And of course, it gives us a lot of long-term information that we wouldn't otherwise have for long-term research on the effects of using vitamins and minerals on an exercise, on, you know, eating well, because of course we try to encourage all our clients to eat organically, clean water, and also to exercise. So it's a lot of variables that we have, and we're hoping that long-term all of this information will be used in our research. So that's a little bit of an overview, Corey.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's extensive, and I know that we could have a whole discussion just on the packs themselves and all the research data. And thank God you've got books that people can understand so they can buy them and read them. And I just believe that anybody in the field should have every single one of your books as part of their library.
For most people, if you read a scientific paper, they do not understand what the implications are, even sometimes what it means, because scientists tend to use very grandiose words and ones that we don't understand. So our goal has always been to try to take that research, to simplify it, and to make it, put it into a practical use so that everyone out there can then apply that to their lives and make their lives better.
That's wonderful. Now, did you have an athletic background yourself before you met Michael?
Yes and no. I don't know if you can call sailing athletic, but that, of course, Auckland is one of the yachting capitals of the world, and I had done that since I was about 5 years of age. I'd raced competitively and sailed competitively, so that was my athletic background.
Wow. And what about your parents? Were they born in New Zealand? And what was your childhood like growing up in New Zealand?
My father was actually from England. He was born in England and got to New Zealand eventually by going from the Royal Navy to the New Zealand Navy. My mother was born in New Zealand, so I'm half and half, I suppose. Growing up in New Zealand, you know, it was actually very idyllic. In some ways, I think it's a little bit like growing up in Canada and outside of the major cities. You know, it's clean, small town. Even though I grew up in Auckland, which, of course, is the biggest city in New Zealand, I grew up in the suburbs in a beautiful area, actually a lot like Salt Spring, lots of trees, lots of beaches. So we spent a lot of our time at the beach and outdoors, again, growing our own food and things like that. My grandfather, who's fairly ancient now, he's in his late 80s, he still has his own vegetable garden and still grows a lot of his own food and is still quite active, fishes every day as well. So it's the kind of environment where you can still do that.
Isn't the orange roughy a type of fish that's native to the
you know,
waters
it's interesting.
There?
Orange roughy I never discovered until I moved to the U.S. I mean, there was a lot of fish that we ate. Orange roughy wasn't one of them.
Oh, is that right?
But I have since heard that they fished it out. It was a more deep ocean water fish, so it's really only accessible to fishing boats. We used to go out and fish, but the most common fish we'd eat would be snapper, of course, which, you know, you could go sailing and pull into this beautiful, pristine little bay, and you threw your line overboard, and the next minute you'd have a couple of fish ready to put in your pot and eat. So I am very used to eating extremely fresh fish.
How wonderful is that?
It is. Isn't that great?
No kidding. Now, I know you've got a connection to horses. When we were at the camp this last year in the summer, we saw them. We saw what you've done with the resort, and you've got obviously a certain charm with horses, a certain love. How did that develop? And talk about your equestrian center and what you're offering there as well.
Well, like most young girls, I always wanted a horse. Unfortunately, the area that I lived in didn't sort of cater to that. So when we were in San Diego and our oldest daughter, Megan, was born, she expressed an interest in taking up riding. And that's really how we got started to get into it in a big way. So I would take her out for her lessons when she was five, but she seemed to be having way too much fun to me. So I also joined, and so we learnt together. Unfortunately for me, Megan got way better than I did, but, you know, we still would compete. And then Michael also decided we were having too much fun, and he got into it as well. And so there was a short period of time there where we would be extremely busy. We owned five horses, and we'd all be competing in shows, hunter jumper shows down there in California, like every weekend throughout the summer. So we became very, very busy, and it is a very athletic sport, though I'm sure a lot of people's idea of sitting on a horse isn't, you know, they don't think of it as being something that makes you very fit, but it really does. So that's how we started. Megan and we still owned horses when we moved to Salt Spring, so we brought the horses up here with us when we came. But the problem we found, especially on Salt Spring, not so much in Vancouver, of course, but here on Salt Spring, was there was no facilities. And when winter came, everyone sort of closed up shop and went away. And so, as you know, as an athlete yourself, Corey, you cannot compete competitively if you're not training all year round. And by the time most of the children here on Salt Spring get back into shape and their horses get back into shape in the summertime, it's the very end of the season and you've missed most of the shows. So we had sort of tried to get together with different groups of people to arrange getting some sort of indoor arena facility that the children could ride through the winter in, and we had the opportunity to do it ourselves finally when this property came on the market. It's a beautiful property, as you know. And so after we purchased it, we had an indoor arena built, and suddenly we had all these horses again. So we are back into it, but it's a great facility. It's great for the kids. We developed a school program here as well, so that the little kids on the island, we have lots of 6 and 7 year olds whose parents can't actually afford a horse, but who can come out and ride ours, and they get instruction from our trainers, and it's just great to watch them blossoming and riding. And so it's been very fulfilling as well, though it's kind of a hobby.
one and the same. You've made your hobby a business and your business a hobby.
It is. It is kind of a major hobby now, yes.
That's awesome. Now, how does your method of feeding them and the supplements you feed them and give them, how you train them, how does that differ from, say, mainstream care of horses? Or is it the same, or are there some differences?
No, it is quite different. Well, it's different from, I think, what the average person may perceive. I know we talked about it when you were over here last year, that we consider the horse, especially the competitive horse, as much an athlete as the person that is riding it. It's a team sport. Riding is a team sport, and you can only be as good as your team member is. So if your horse is out of shape or your horse hasn't been trained properly, he's not fit enough, then obviously he's not going to give his optimum performance either. And it applies the same with yourself. I mean, it's not as big a team as a hockey team, but, you know, every member of the team is important. So when you see at Olympic level, especially any of the equestrian sports, you know that the both members of that team are looked after extremely well. I mean, horses get massages now as well. They have to get proper training programs. So if you've got a competition coming up, especially a major one, you will start training for that, you and your horse, like 3 months before the actual event so that you peak for that event. It really is no different than any other sport. So their nutrition is important as well. And we discussed this a little bit earlier when we were talking about forage animals. And horses are naturally forage animals, so it's really important that they get good quality forage, that is good quality grass or hay, and their supplements as well. And we give all our horses supplements as well as part of their daily diet. And some of them will get extra nutrients, just like we'll give extra nutrients to your athletes, and perhaps like glucosamine and chondroitin if you know that there's a lot of joint stress. For instance, if you think about a jumper as opposed to a racehorse, a jumper has a lot of stress on its joints just from taking off and landing on the other side of a jump. So they need that joint support just as much as any athlete would who was maybe doing long jump. We view them exactly the same then as we would a human athlete.
Exactly, and that's why you take better care of them and probably equal to your own care, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you're out there doing, for instance, an endurance ride, it's the same as doing a marathon. And if you haven't trained that horse up to be able to do that 100-mile endurance run, and remember it's done over very rough country, then he's going to fail because they have regular vet checks. And you're not going to finish the race, so you're not going to win. So, and obviously, when we compete, we all want to win. So we have to put the best we can out, and you have to take care of the other member of your team, too.
Absolutely. Now, isn't it true also, because I've seen some of the studies, that supplements that are used by humans, like I know HMB and some of the ergogenic aids, were originally used in horses and horse racing, and they found them to be of benefit for enhancing performance, and then that literature came out, and then people started taking them?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of the things have been used for a long time in horses because, of course, there's an awful lot of money in racing. In the thoroughbred racing field, things have been used there, like, for instance, I know you understand about the buffering of phosphates. Well, they've been using that with horses, drenching horses with bicarbonate of soda for years and years before it was even thought of using it for people for the same reason. The glucosamine, chondroitin, hyaluronic acid, for instance, has been injected into horse joints for some time as well. And they inject it directly into the joint because they understand that's where it needs to be, whereas we still generally take it by mouth. So there's a lot of advances in what you might call athletics and supplements that were used in the equine world long before they, and still are used there, even though they're not used so much in with people anymore.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. So what we feed them relates to a paradigm of what we feed ourselves. And so, again, we can learn by studying animals and how they live and how they've changed. Take that information, apply it to ourselves, and gain great value.
Absolutely, Corey, absolutely.
Now, let's get into a couple of the books that you were involved in terms of writing and research. One that fascinates me is The Flavonoid Revolution. I think that the flavonoid family is, like my understanding, it's really super huge, and we're just learning, you know, tidbits of each one of those hundreds of members. But maybe you could shine some light on what a flavonoid is and how taking those things could be of benefit to us.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. There are a huge number of phytochemicals, which include the flavonoids and carotenoids, available in plants and vegetables. Probably, they think, more than 20,000. And of these, we only know a few hundred at this point in time. So you can see there's still a huge amount of research to be done. Essentially, flavonoids are a class of nutrients that come from what we call polyphenols. I'm sure most people have heard that name now. And polyphenols, or plants make polyphenols from the amino acid phenylalanine, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. And they're responsible for the colors that we see in our fruits and vegetables. And they also tend to be somewhat astringent, so like the taste that you get in green tea or dry red wines and lots of herbs, that sort of sharp taste, that's also your flavonoids. They're a huge class, and they color your vegetables, which is one of the reasons why we agree so much with Sam Gracie that you should make sure that you have a very colorful plate of food every day, because that tells you you're getting a lot of your carotenoids and your flavonoids. And as you know, our ancestors were hunter-gatherers, and they ate a huge variety of plants and seeds. And we need to get back to more to that kind of a diet, because we're missing a large number of these plant flavonoids and the other phytochemicals that are in there. Because, as I said, we only know a few hundred of them now, and only a few of them have actually been processed enough now and studied enough that we can actually put them in pills for people to take. So it's so important for people every day to get their fresh fruits and vegetables.
So the purples, the greens, the yellows, the reds, so they like the lutein, the lycopene, the zeaxanthin,
exactly.
All these things, and don't they have like enormous antioxidant value to protect
absolutely.
Cells?
Most of the flavonoids are very potent antioxidants, and they have a huge amount of other functions as well. So not only are they involved in immune function, but they're involved in gene expression and capillary and blood flow and platelet aggregation, liver function, enzyme activity, our skin, our brains, you know, everywhere. They're so important.
I got time for one more question. And because I want to mention the great book, You Can Prevent Cancer. Leslie, this is such a huge concern in so many people. I remember when cancer, like, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, it was like a death sentence. And now people are learning to live with it. It's permeating all of society. What can you recommend to people? Like, what are some of the real gold nuggets in the book? Because I want everyone to get out there and read this book. It's a massive resource of help for everyone in our family. But what are some of the gold nuggets that you might want to share with us before we go?
Well, I think that the most important thing, if no one takes anything else away, I think the most important thing about cancer is that it is preventable. And most people, you know, it's lifestyle choices that make this so important. There's been some major research now, as I'm sure you're aware of it, and Michael talks about it in the book as well, that shows that genetics do not play a leading role in cancer at all. It's prevention strategies that are going to reduce cancer deaths. And in fact, the latest research now predicts that if we applied prevention well, we could reduce cancer death by a whopping 29%. So 29% more people would be saved, whereas regular treatment will only maybe save another 4%. So you can see the huge difference there that prevention is going to make. And I think the thing that's most important for people to do is to concentrate on eliminating first the really big risks. I mean, you know, there are so many things that we know that we're every day we're told about that cause cancer, you know, from the chlorine in your tap water to the pesticides on your fruits and vegetables, that it overwhelms everyone and they don't know where to start. And I think the thing that they need to know is that there are major risk factors, and if you eliminate those, the other risk factors are much smaller. So the big four that they need to take away from, the first one, of course, is smoking. Smoking causes about 30% of all cancers. Eliminate that. And it's so gratifying to see so many countries now are starting to eliminate smoking in public areas and public places. So that's a huge step. Second one that's really important is obesity and inactivity. You can't afford to be overweight and you can't afford to be inactive. You have to keep moving. You have to keep that weight off. Obesity alone causes about 25% of cancers. So if you can prevent yourself from being overweight, and smoking, if you combine those two, that's 50% of the risk factors right there. Third one that's important, people should make sure that they eat a good diet, and especially for those living in the city where it's more difficult, make sure you take your supplements, because they're a great prevention, great insurance policy. And probably the fourth one is, unfortunately, is chronic viruses and other infections, but that's only 7% of cancer causes. So you can see that the three major ones there are easily preventable. All of us can do something immediately about not smoking, not being exposed to smoke, by making sure we don't get obese, by keeping active, and by taking our supplements every day.
Wow, that's just wonderful advice, Leslie. Thank you so much for that. And now, if anyone wants to buy your books, find out about the camps, the anti-aging camp, the Power Program camp, what is your website that they can go to and buy and find out about this stuff?
The website, Corey, is just colganinstitute.com, just one word. And all the information is there, plus all our phone numbers and other contact information as well.
That's wonderful. So that's www.colganinstitute.com. And I'm sure most of you listening right now are well familiar with that website. You can get to it through CoreyHawley.com as well, because we are linked like sisters and brothers and
we
part of the
indeed.
Community. And Leslie, it's our privilege to know you. Trace and I, we love you and Michael. We love what you do. We think that you're just absolutely incredible and wonderful. And again, we look forward to seeing you very soon. And I've been speaking with Leslie Colgan, president of the Colgan Institute, a fabulous consulting educational research facility. And Leslie is definitely the power behind the throne. So thank you very much, Leslie.
Thank
Look
you
forward
so
to hearing
much,
from
Corey.
You again.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.